Thank you very much, Paula. And actually, I found it very interesting looking at the situation in Asia, and particularly in the paper on Malaysia, because I felt there are a number of parallels with what's happening in Canada and perhaps in the United States. But like Jennifer, I'll start off with my conclusions. And first of all, I'd like to explain that I'm not an economist, so I'm going to talk more than rely on numbers. But the first, and this is the point that others have made, is that temporary labor migration is a structural feature in East Asia, Southeast Asia, and has been for over 40 years, and that Asia's export-oriented growth was really dependent on a large migrant labor force. And also that the region's reliance on Western European and American markets made the region extremely vulnerable. And we see that specifically in looking at the electronics and garments sectors where women are employed. There have been massive job losses, a lot of them we hear about in the newspaper, but they're very differing reports for migrant workers. And this is where it becomes interesting in looking at the different sorts of stories and data. We might ask whether there's been an increase in undocumented workers as documented workers have been laid off. Are we looking at a situation where the push factors in labor-sending countries may be stronger than what I call the push-out factor in the labor-receiving countries? And, for example, when men are laid off in the labor-sending countries, are women then seeking employment in foreign countries? In terms of impacts, what some of the research shows, but also some of the NGO reports, are that we're seeing cuts in working hours, deteriorating working conditions. Women are still trying to remit to their families, and they're taking on the kinds of work which puts them in increased situation of vulnerability. I wanted to look at possible strategies, and one of them are in some of the human rights and labor frameworks through the ILO and particularly CEDAW, and then perhaps through trade or other agreements that some labor-sending countries have engaged in through cooperation agreements. And then I'll conclude with some suggestions in terms of recommendations. So hopefully I will get through all this. Women, migrant labor in Asia, women now make up about half of migrant workforce in Asia. And as I mentioned, it's unclear at present the extent to which the crisis in Asia will result in the large-scale deportations that we saw after the 1997 crisis, because the export-oriented growth strategy of the region still depends on a large migrant labor force. There have been a lot of concerns that have been expressed by countries, also my own country, about the effects of growing protectionism in some developed countries. For example, some of the bailout measures that are dependent on maintenance of domestic jobs in France, Italy, and Spain, for example. And India has protested the U.S. government's decision to exclude from stimulus tax breaks those American companies that move jobs overseas. As I mentioned, there are different reports on the impacts of the crisis on migrant workers in the region. Faced with the increasing likelihood of poor employment prospects at home, laid-off documented workers may move into irregular status to accept precarious work in the host country. Just a few snapshots, and again, some of the presentations this morning made the case very dramatically. The Asian Development Bank has forecast 3.6% growth in East Asia this year, down from 6.6% growth last year, and just 0.7% growth in Southeast Asia. And they're forecasting negative growth in Hong Kong, China, Korea, and Taiwan. Of course, these are countries that are extremely dependent on export markets in Europe and the United States. The ILO has also revised its forecast down in May to 0.7%. In exports, the World Bank reports major declines in exports from all major Asian producers. Now, according to the bank, three broad product groups account for about half of the region's exports. These are electronics, oil, and garments. Countries that are heavily dependent on electronics, which is a major employer of women in the EPZs and also informally, women, of course, have constituted a flexible workforce that works on contract. Those worst affected are Taiwan, whose merchandise exports dropped 44.5% in the period January to January 2009. Thailand is down 28%, Philippines down 40%, and Malaysia down 34%. And these declines, of course, have major implications for employment. And again, there are many stories, thank you. For example, that story in the China Post that as many as 400,000 Indonesians, about a tenth of those working in Malaysia, are being sent home. Most developing countries in Asia report actual or expected declines in both foreign and domestic investment. And just to flag the point that the service sector is also affected, and women are represented in tourism-dependent sectors. Cambodia, Egypt, Jordan, Morocco, and Thailand are facing major reductions in foreign investment. The data on remittances varies, and I think this also points to the need for much better data. Recent World Bank figures suggest that remittance flows, they have a series of scenarios forecasting declines of from 4 to about 8% in 2009, but they link these somewhat with exchange rate fluctuations. And the study notes that although newspapers report large numbers of migrants returning, that they find that new migration flows are still positive. So to me, this suggests maybe that worsening employment conditions in the labor-sending countries are exerting a strong pressure on workers to migrate. The increase in stock of migrants coupled with a decrease in remittances could also suggest that in addition to the effects of exchange rates, wages for migrants may be dropping, and we heard a lot about this at a recent ILO UNIFEM forum in Bangkok, or that costs of living for migrants may be increasing as employers download employment costs on workers. Now, looking more closely at migrant workers in Asia, there are about 15 to 20 million intra-regional workers in Southeast and East Asia, and most of them are unregistered. So again, it's difficult to get a complete picture. The case of Malaysia I find quite interesting because it raises or it illustrates a number of features of temporary foreign worker programs. One is their tendency to become permanent, their tendency to be ad hoc responses for employer demands for cheap, flexible labor, and also the difficulty that governments face in trying to enforce effective protection for migrant workers. Now, statistics on migrant workers in Malaysia vary. There are about 3 million workers in a total workforce of 11 million, and there are about 800,000 undocumented workers. About half of the registered workers are from Indonesia, and of course there are very large numbers of Indonesian domestic workers. Although the government announced plans to reduce the number of foreign workers to about almost 2 million by the year 2010 and 1.6 million by 2015, the data actually suggests that they've been having difficulty reaching that target, and we'll talk about that a bit. In January this year, Malaysia announced a ban on the hiring of foreign labor in manufacturing and service sectors, and companies were ordered to lay off foreign workers first if they have to come back, and this is the so-called foreign workers out first policy. But skilled foreign workers were exempted. Now, a major NGO in Malaysia, Tenaganita, I'm sure many people of you know it, has been working on to protect the rights of workers and migrants in Malaysia. And they've been doing some work on another policy of the Malaysian government, which is outsourcing as a new form of recruitment for foreign workers. And again, this experience, I think, is illustrative of problems that many countries experience with trying to regulate labor recruiters. Some of the problems which both Tenaganita and also the Federation of Malaysian Employers or Manufacturers have pointed out is that there's a tendency for workers being hired for one kind of job and then finding they're employed in an entirely different sector. There's problems with over-recruitment, and there's problems with tracking workers. Various government measures to address political sensitivities around the large numbers of foreign workers have had mixed success. Ministry of Labour statistics on retrenchments in the manufacturing subsectors for May, for example. And again, these don't reflect the large numbers of irregular migrant workers, show that more local workers than foreign workers have been retrenched. Almost 5,700 local workers compared with 178 foreign workers. One of the plans the government had was to try to replace reliance on Indonesian domestic workers by encouraging training for Malaysian women to move into the sector, but there doesn't seem to have been much pickup. So briefly, the reported effects in the region include loss of employment, a shift to undocumented status, and again, this puts women in particular in an extremely vulnerable situation. Wages are likely to fall. Some of the industries, though, are reporting that it's not so much that workers are being laid off as that the numbers of hours are being reduced. There's a loss of overtime, but it was this overtime which actually brought wages up to a living level. Some of the NGOs at the UNIFEM ILO forum in Bangkok reported that the migrant worker women that they were working with are taking on additional part-time jobs to make up for wage reductions in order to send home enough money. And these were jobs in very precarious and dangerous situations. Working conditions are worsening. A number of host countries are adopting more restrictive immigration policies, and so on. Now, looking briefly at the legal framework for migrant workers' rights, I think the structural dependence of the key economic sectors in Asia, export-oriented economies, suggests that labor migration will continue through the crisis, but that conditions for migrant workers will probably worsen. So this suggests to me that policy responses need to include measures to protect the rights of migrants. The major international framework, the International Convention on the Protection of Rights of All Migrant Workers and Their Families, and ILO migration conventions have been signed and ratified by very few countries, and it's mostly labor-sending countries. Decent work for domestic workers is on the agenda for the International Labor Conference in 2010, and there's a proposal for an ILO convention on domestic workers. CEDAW, which sets out what constitutes discrimination, struck me as being offering perhaps more traction. And last year, the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women issued a recommendation on migrant women workers, drawing attention particularly that while states are entitled to control their borders and regulate migration, they must do so in compliance with their obligations as parties to the human rights treaties they have ratified or to which they have acceded. I found that there's an interesting guide on gender-sensitive labor migration policies, which takes a rights-based approach to promoting. This has been developed by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, and we can talk a bit about that. Looking at bilateral labor agreements, some countries have negotiated agreements. However, labor-sending countries really don't negotiate from strength on the issue of labor migration, since the receiving countries really do not want to make commitments in this area, particularly at a time of economic recession and rising unemployment. Some, though, argue that labor mobility should be included within a free trade agreement to make any worker scheme binding and thereby prevent labor receiving countries from sending workers home when unemployment rises or if there are political tensions. Some governments, particularly the Philippines, have been done some interesting work in negotiating memorandums of understanding. They are political rather than legally binding. But they do offer some interesting entry points. I noticed that the Philippine government has negotiated memorandums of understanding with several Canadian provinces. These are between the ministers of employment and immigration and labor, not between trade ministers or heads of government. But they include provisions for contracts, for annual review meetings, measures to control recruitment and credential recognition, which is particularly important for women. And they also include undertakings for the Canadian provinces to promote human resources development activities within the Philippines. A number of other countries have negotiated bilateral labor agreements, for example, Taiwan with Thailand and Vietnam, and Korea with several other countries. So to conclude, I wanted to put out a few suggestions on measures that could promote the rights of women migrant workers. And one is to encourage national governments or regional organizations to look for good practice in gender-sensitive migration in both the sending, and I guess the transit, and the receiving countries by looking for ways to implement the CEDAW's General Recommendation 26. As I mentioned, most countries have ratified CEDAW, and so perhaps it offers entry points which might not be available through the UN convention. And also, the CSW offers a mechanism for reporting, monitoring, and compliance. And I've got to wrap up. One is to look to ways to include domestic work in national labor legislation, to think about coordinated responses, and also a plea for more and better sex disaggregated data on migrant workers. Thank you.